Welcome to the Resolving Violence Podcast, created to deliver current Canadian prairie-based research on violence and abuse to service providers, people with lived experience, and the general public. I'm Jordan. And if you'd like to learn more about factors that influence violence and the ways you can address them, let's get started.
Hi, Jordan. It's so exciting to finally do a podcast episode together. So we're talking today about your grounded theory paper. And as we both know, this is a huge reason why I wanted to work with you and be your student. I think at this point, I've probably read this paper about 6 times. And every time I read it, it's like when you watch a movie for like the second or third time. And when you watch it, you're like, oh, I didn't notice that the first time. That's how I feel every time I read this paper. I'm always learning something new. So I'm really looking forward to actually getting to talk to you about it and not just reading it over and over again.
I'm looking forward to talking about it too. I agree. I think there's a lot in here.
Yeah. You just learn more every time. So do you want to start by explaining the background of what brought you to do this paper and the gap that you were addressing with it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I got interested in parents' experiences of their child's trauma when I was a graduate student. So I was working with my advisor on, she was working on a randomized controlled trial, a dissemination project of trauma-focused CBT. And trauma-focused CBT is considered by many to be the gold standard of treatment for children who've experienced trauma. It treats symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder in particular. But the treatment is really designed to target children's experiences and children's symptoms. So I worked on that project both as a research assistant, and I also did a practicum placement providing the therapy for kids. And what I noticed kept happening over and over again is that parents would express that they would benefit from a place to process their own experiences about what had happened to their child. But trauma-focused CBT doesn't really provide space for that in the same way it would as if a parent was going for their own treatment. So that's what kind of sparked my interest in parents' experiences around their child's trauma. And then going into the literature at the time, there was a lot of evidence about parents' emotional responses. We knew a lot about how they felt after their child experienced a trauma, so disappointed, worried, angry, hopeless, blaming themselves. Those are common reactions. But there wasn't really a ton of research on what parents actually do in response to the child's trauma and how they help the child through that process. I think it's really important for us to understand what parents do to help children, because most children who would benefit from a psychotherapy are not going to receive a psychotherapy. Access is too limited. And parents, even for children who are maybe benefiting from a therapist, parents spend way more time with their child than a therapist would. So understanding what that influence is going to be in the family is really important. And we also know from the research that parents play a really important moderating role on how children do following trauma. So when parents are able to respond in a positive, supportive way, children are more likely to have a positive outcome. But there was not a lot of work on what parents actually do in response to this experience. And so this project was really designed to fill that gap.
Yeah, I really like how you brought up that parents are the ones that spend all of the time with their kid. I think it's common for people to think like, oh, if I bring my kid to therapy, they're going to deal with it. They're going to fix the problem and I can just leave it to them. So I think you noted a really important thing in that it is like very important how the parent is responding to these things and their role in how the family and the child get better following a trauma. So you use grounded theory for this. And I know I've mentioned in previous episodes when we've talked about grounded theory papers that I just think grounded theory is super interesting methodology, especially because it can be used in so many different ways and under so many different frameworks. So do you want to explain how you use grounded theory in this project?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'll start by talking about why grounded theory. And this project took, almost 7 years from start to finish, and it's still ongoing. And this is the project that got me into qualitative methods. You know, so this is a project really near and dear to my heart for that reason as well. So grounded theory allows you to build a model of people's experiences of a social phenomenon in an inductive way, which means that you are not applying a model to the data, but allowing the theory to emerge from the data. And that's really important for capturing parents' own lived experiences. So this is a model of what parents describe having gone through naturalistically. Some of them had interventions and some of them did not. But, you know, there was a lot of, okay, I don't want to say a lot. The research that did exist at the time that I started this project was very much correlational. It wasn't theoretical. And the difference between developing a theory from, you know, maybe correlational studies is that a theory is going to help us explain and predict something. So explain why something occurs and then allow us to predict what someone might experience when they, for example, their child experiences a trauma. So theory plays a really important role in both research and practice because it allows us to do that explaining and predicting. But, you know, using grounded theory in this project meant, you know, interviewing parents with very broad interview questions about their experiences. And then over time, altering those interview questions and either going back to old participants to ask them more or asking new questions of new participants. And I kind of think of grounded theory in some ways, making me a little bit of like a research lawyer in the sense that like my job is to find evidence for what seems to be coming out of the data and query that evidence and see if that is indeed what's being seen. And so this project was really, like I said, I think I started in 2011. You know, this iterative process of interviewing, analyzing, re-interviewing, redeveloping questions. I love grounded theory because it's such a creative process. And this project is obviously about a uncomfortable topic, but the process of grounded theory was actually quite joyful in this project for me.
That's awesome. And I guess this is a good time to say how important I think qualitative research is, because, you know, quantitative data obviously has its place, but with qualitative, you really get to the heart of what those experiences are. And just in my experience in reading qualitative papers, you know, you really get an idea of what these people are going through that you don't exactly get with quantitative data. So with that, do you want to explain the results of this project and what theory came out of it?
So what I found was that parents go through this three-phase process, beginning when they learn about the traumatic experience your child has had. And in this sample, those types of traumas included things like extreme bullying, child sexual abuse, physical abuse, and, you know, children disclose at various times to their parents. So that's kind of the starting point, is when parents are learning about this experience. And what happens in that first phase is that parents feel quite destabilized. You know, in some ways, there becomes this very clear before and after time point for parents. The very first thing that happened that was really interesting as a researcher is this idea of what I ended up calling violated expectations, but really is more like a shattered worldview for the parent. And that includes, you know, shattered expectations that something like this would never happen to their child, or that the perpetrator would never do something like this to their child. And parents respond to that by going into what, like a protective mode around their child, to keep the child safe and help the child move through this process, while experiencing as few harms as possible. And so the parent's life really begins to center around the child's trauma. You know, and then there's this process in destabilization where parents are really focused on making it better. That's the primary goal for the parent, is to make this experience better for the child. And that includes, you know, this combination of searching for what needs to be done. And that's a lot of trial and error. So trying various things to see if they help with the child's healing. And I'm being really broad because those things included a range of behaviors and activities. There was also this sense of trying to protect the child almost by like placing padding around them, like making sure that they are, you know, safe in experiences, that they're not being re-traumatized. And through this process of looking for the right thing to do and trial and error, parents who were able to keep moving through this process did eventually reach, you know, this tipping point where the child began to heal, so the parent began to heal. And it's really important to mention, I think, that parents don't seem to heal if the child isn't healing. There's no such thing as in this model. And the research that Whitney Wolcott-Benoit has done on this topic, you know, the parent's healing and the child's healing are tied together. The parents were eventually able to move into this phase where they regained some stability and life became more than just about the trauma at that point. And continuing through that recalibration into the third phase of stabilization, you know, parents describe their family experiencing what I call thriving recovery. So not only having recovered from the traumatic experience, but life changing in ways that weren't anticipated. So for example, improved family communication. A lot of families also reported things like, we don't keep secrets anymore. And so, you know, it's not just a matter of going back to the way life was before the trauma, which is arguably not possible, but a different life afterwards. You know, and a related concept within the psychology literature is post-traumatic growth. So something that's really important in this paper that I think often gets overlooked in it is that parents were experiencing vicarious post-traumatic growth. And this is really the first study to document that loved ones can experience their own growth from a trauma they didn't experience directly.
Yeah. For anybody listening, if you go look at the paper, Jordan has a very large diagram explaining this whole process. And it's a lot to take in and so many pieces of it, like the whole thing, honestly, to me is so interesting. So theory highlights how a lot of uncomfortable experiences that occur following a traumatic event are almost necessary for recovery, I guess you could say, and specifically for that thriving recovery and post-traumatic growth. But it also highlights the ways that parents can get stuck and not able to move forward. Can you talk about some of the reasons that families were not able to reach that point of thriving recovery?
Absolutely. You know, and two examples come to mind of parents or caregivers I interviewed that didn't actually complete this process. So one thing that was quite surprising and that you kind of mentioned in this question is the idea that experiencing these violated expectations is actually central to being able to move through this process. So parents in this study needed that shattered worldview in order to pull together the emotional and psychological resources and the energy to work on going into protective mode, looking after their child. That required a lot of personal effort on an emotional, psychological, and sometimes literal level. And without having those violated expectations, you know, there was, for example, one or two parents who did not experience this worldview being shattered, who did not progress through the model. So this paper seems to indicate that even though that is a terrible experience, that it is necessary. Other examples were situations, for example, where, you know, maybe children were older, so adolescents who, you know, refused to participate in treatment, and the family felt that was a really important piece of healing for them. And if the child or adolescent wasn't able to begin recovering, the parent didn't recover either. I think that's another example that, again, kind of highlights that the parent experiences and the child experiences are yoked together. You know, and I will add, when I started this project, I didn't have a child. And I had a child shortly after this paper was published. And that absolutely changes my perspective on that idea. Because, you know, when I started interviewing parents, it was very difficult. You'd ask a parent to describe their experience of their child's trauma, and they would tell you the child's story. That they're so intertwined together, the parent's experience and the child's experience. I think it also highlights why we need to understand the parent's experience to help the whole family as a unit, because this isn't something that's only experienced by a child, it's experienced by the whole family together.
Yeah, I can only imagine how hard it would be to try to untangle as a parent, which I am not, but as a parent, trying to untangle what you are experiencing kind of independently from what your child went through. And, you know, trying to get that information out in an interview, I can imagine would be quite difficult.
Related to that, Ariana, there's a project that isn't finished that we haven't published yet, but interviewed parents about what gets in the way of their needs when they're going through this experience. And the majority of parents say, like, this is not about me. This is about making my child feel better and getting them through this experience. It would be selfish of me to consider what I need in this process. And so the child really is central to this experience for the parents as well.
Yeah. So one thing that I always get caught up on in a study and is super relevant to our listeners is one sub process going back to the first stage, the destabilization phase, is parents being let down by service providers, the justice system, things like that. Can you talk a bit more about this experience and how it impacts parenting responses and the navigation of trauma?
Yeah, absolutely. So as parents are going through that process of trying to make things better, there was a lot of experiences of being really let down by the systems. In fact, for a lot of parents, this was another stage of violated expectations. You know, I'll give what was a common example. So, you know, parents would receive a disclosure of their child's trauma. They would contact an appropriate profession to begin dealing with that. So, for example, police services, their family physician, the emergency room. You know, and before these experiences happened to these families, they always assumed that when such an experience happens to families, there is a system to catch you. And the system will guide you through what you're supposed to do afterward. And most parents described there being no such system and being really surprised by that. So that was the first place that people were let down, is just the sheer amount of effort they had to put in themselves to finding the resources that they assumed this were there for families that experienced this. You know, the other ways that families could get let down, you know, for example, people not understanding, service providers who blame the parent for what happened, even if the parent is not the perpetrator. In the project that I mentioned to you about understanding barriers to help for the parents, another common barrier that came up for them is not being able to find service providers to help them with their experience. Was something that kind of, you know, was a letdown for them as well. And then sometimes there were informal ways that they were let down. So by their families or friends, you know, who didn't either distance themselves from this experience, or for some families, they felt like it became a source of gossip in their family. So they pulled themselves away from their family. So a lot of places where expectations were just not met.
Yeah. And that's a really good segue into our last question. So based on what you learned in developing this theory and all of the experience that you have, if you were to give a service provider one practice to work toward in the long term and one simple thing that they can begin implementing today, what would that be?
I don't know if I can stick to one thing. I'm probably going to have one thing to say. I think the very first thing is understanding that this is an experience happening to a family, not necessarily happening to just a child. And that we want to move towards being able to provide support in whatever form that looks like to the parents who are trying to help their child in this experience. Because we know that parents are one of the biggest predictors of childhood outcomes after trauma, it's really important to make sure that we're supporting those parents, because they are playing one of the biggest roles in how that child's going to recover. The other thing too is that, you know, parents sometimes have their own trauma experiences that they may or may not have received help for, that may or may not feel processed to them. And some parents will have experiences in their own background that have not been addressed that will be activated by their child's experience. Those parents in particular will need help moving through their own healing while they help their child heal as well. You know, so I think that's one thing to begin thinking of immediately is regardless of who in that family you may be working with, seeing them as a unit that's impacted as a unit. You know, I think that one thing, you know, that I mentioned in the paper is also understanding that we have to go through the messiness and the difficulty in order to heal, that we have to actually go through that experience. We can't dampen that or take that away from our clients, for example, that is actually part of the process. And then I think long term, you know, we need more services that provide help for parents. Parents have a lot of that idea of being let down. Like, parents will give you a long list of things that could make the system better. And they have great suggestions for that safety net that they think should come into play when something's experienced, and it's not always there. And it requires a lot of advocacy and work on the parent's part to receive help that not every parent has the resources or the time or the ability to do. So I think long-term, we need to begin building in supports and services for parents in addition to children to support that whole family when they're going through an experience of trauma.
Yeah, that's a lot to unpack and think about. One thing that I have thought about is, do you think that the theory itself has clinical utility in terms of, like, say you have a family coming in following a trauma, showing the theory in some way, maybe not how it's presented in the paper, do you think that having families kind of see the process that they are likely about to go through would be beneficial?
That's a really good question. I don't know if I can give like a yes or no to that question. I do know, for example, that being able to normalize some of the experiences of families is important. And for example, there are ways that trauma-focused CBT does that. I'll give you an example. It's quite common for, I'll give you two examples, actually. It's quite common for children who've been through trauma to have externalizing behaviors, to begin acting out. And it's very helpful to be able to normalize that for parents and say, like, this is to be expected. Let's talk about how to help. Another thing that often happens to families in this situation, and this came out in the piece of what I called padding the child, is that parents experience a lot of uncertainty around things like rules, discipline, boundaries for a child who's been through trauma. So not knowing, like, should we have our usual rules? I don't want to discipline my child for this thing I normally would discipline them for because they've been through this difficult experience. You know, I think prior to having children, I would have had very concrete things I would suggest that clients do. I no longer have that hubris that I think I had before children, because now, you know, I'd recommend, like, figuring out with a family what works for them. But understanding that in a lot of situations, a child can benefit from continuing the normality of what was in place before. You know, not rigidly, not saying that you shouldn't ever adjust those boundaries and discipline and expectations, but that you need to also think long term, you know, what is going to be helpful for the child in the long run. For some children, that predictability is a nice stability for them.
Yeah. And while I would anticipate that fully removing those kinds of things would also have negative impacts on a child. So yeah. Do you have anything else you'd like to add before we close off the episode?
I think I would just like to add, maybe this is a little bit of a research angle, but, you know, this paper is published in Child Abuse and Neglect, which doesn't always publish qualitative work. So I was quite happy that they accepted this paper and it would go to a journal where hopefully it will be used. Yeah, and I think as well, you know, this project is ongoing. There's lots of future questions. So, like, this isn't the end of that theory. There's much more work to do to tease out some of these pieces and possibly pieces that are missing. So, you know, as I do more research and my students do more research in the lab, this will continue to develop over time.
Can you give any examples of future questions that you want to address?
I can mention, Whitney Wilcock-Benoit's dissertation. I think she's going to be on an episode at some point. You know, she looked at how parents may or may not centralize the child's trauma, and event centralization predicts things like post-traumatic stress disorder in people who directly experience trauma. And centralization means essentially making this story one of the most important aspects of who you are. And, Whitney's dissertation looked at whether or not parents are doing that vicariously. And I won't go into the details because I'll let her talk herself on the episode. But I think that's an example of where, you know, there's a construct that did apply to these parents that wasn't in my awareness at the time. I didn't have what Granite Theory would call a theoretical sensitivity to that. So there are continued pieces. I also think, personally, my next two research questions, I would to get into the violated expectations piece and understand more about that. And also to just really look at those experiences of disclosure. So for example, anecdotally, a lot of children disclosed to their parents when they were driving in cars. So I think looking at, you know, what is that experience of first disclosure like for a parent as well as a child is an important next step too.
Yeah, that was super interesting. As always, just learning more about this paper. Thank you so much for doing this episode with me, Jordan.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Resolving Violence. If you're interested in learning more about today's guests and their research or Resolve Saskatchewan, please check the show notes below. And if what you listened to today was helpful, please consider sharing it with colleagues and on social media so we can work collectively to resolve violence. Thanks again. Until next time.